Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Jonah Moberg.
And I'm Annie. Today we're meeting with Ed McDonough, Democratic Commissioner for the Rensselaer County Board of Elections.
Then WOOC correspondent Megan Marone brings David Borton back for the next installation of Equality Under the Law, our physics segment.
Then we have the first in a series of interviews with local gardeners by high school students learning about farming at Capital Roots in Troy.
And later on, we'll have an interview.
And for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. Next.
Up next, I met with artist and Skidmore professor Adam Tinkle to talk about his life and work. Sanctuary, Adam Tinkle, who is an artist and a professor and a community radio organizer, and anything else?
I think that about covers it.
I guess, could you just talk to us a little bit about your background and what brought you here?
Sure, yeah. So I'm a musician. My background is in music. I've been playing in bands, composing music, playing in a sort of improvisational jazz vein for a very, very long time.
It's like sort of crux of your work is bringing together the worlds of like the experimental and the avant-garde with youth and with communities, you know, average folks. And I think a lot of times experimental art has a reputation, and not, more than a reputation, it's a reality that it is an enclave that's bracketed by class and by race. And so I wonder how it is that you ended up moving outside of those boundaries, and why, and what the story is there.
Oh man, yeah, you're 100% right. There are various art worlds, right? I mean, like every scene around any different kind of genre of music, whether it's like the experimental classical scene or the reggae scene or whatever, like that's its own art world. But when we talk about like capital A art worlds, very frequently we're talking about spaces that are not welcoming to most people and are certainly coded upper class white highly educated, like they're, you know, associated with wealth and legitimated structures of knowledge, and not with community as we usually define it. So I mean, I think I felt some kind of dismay about that situation, like low level understanding that was a thing. And then that feeling intensified around the time of the financial crisis. So that's also right around the time that I went to grad school. It was like, I was in this privileged situation of being a grad student with like a stipend for being a teaching assistant. And I mean, I was at a public university, so it wasn't quite as cloistered as it could have been, but I still felt like, okay, I'm in this rarefied community where people are making work without a clear connection to the catastrophic stuff that's in the news. And so I just kind of felt like a need to connect those dots. And one of my professors got a cold call from a director of a San Diego County Parks and Rec Community Center. And this guy, Ronell Nalon, who's like one of my heroes, like all of my work since then has been somehow like touched by this cold call. He said, you know, we've got karate and we've got like basketball and stuff at the community center, but I want us to have an orchestra, and I have an idea for a name, but I have no idea about what it should be. And I want it to be called the Universal Language Orchestra. And, you know, would you be interested in putting something together? So my professor, you know, buttonholed me in the hallway and said, would you be interested in doing something related to this? And it connected to one of the legacies, one of the experimental music legacies that I was sort of most influenced by, most touched by, which is that of the activism and musical production of the Black Arts Movement and, you know, the free jazz and experimental improvised music of the AACM, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, which is like a community organization and also artistic collaborative organization in Chicago in the 60s up till now, and many parallel organizations all across the country that started in the 1960s responding to a similar set of social crises and feeling of distance between, you know, advanced or avant-garde thinking, art making, and community. And so thought, you know, people have been doing this and I should figure out how I can be doing this too. And so I basically just started doing it and then liked doing it. And then the more I did it, the more I wanted to like find out about it until I wrote my dissertation about it basically.
It's a kind of a clear connection too, in a funny way. A lot of people look at, it like experimental work, you know, whether it's the paintings of like Jackson Pollock or whether it's like noise music or whatever, and say, well, you know, my 5-year-old could do that. And a lot of people in the art world spend a lot of time denying that claim rather than just saying, hey, well, give him a crayon, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a connection that I've been trying to flesh out and make in as many contexts as possible, is that like, if we're freeing our senses of what the arts are from like sort of traditional strictures and prejudices about what is art, what can be in art, who can make art, like you follow that line and all kinds of structures of difference, all kinds of structures of inequality become things that you need to interrogate and question. And obviously we're in a moment where questioning the structures of power and inequality around gender and race is totally in the center of the discourse, as it should be. But like, let's also think about all the other structures of difference and inequality, like people who have taken music or art lessons and people who haven't, people who are old enough to vote and people who aren't, people who are able-bodied and people who have disabilities. Like, all of these structures are also ones that we need to think about when we think about broadening whose artistic expressions should be encouraged and placed in the public sphere.
So how did that work for you personally? It sounds like you were moving into this, like coming from this, from your grad school studies, suddenly moving into this new community where you didn't have any connections and people probably didn't know you, maybe didn't trust you. Or, I mean, how did you navigate that new?
Well, so the whole thing came out of the director of the community center's ideas, and he was deeply embedded. So that one of the first lessons and one of the things that I've tried to take with me is you need someone who's embedded. It's not like everybody has to be equally embedded, but that interaction was made much easier by the fact that he, Rennell, the director of the community center, was our advocate to the parents and to the kids. And his word was good to them. And he said, these people are coming down from UCSD. And, you know, already like the big research university in the city has like a kind of double reputation anywhere. It's like known to be a good place to get an education, and it's also known to be like exclusive and potentially elitist. And so it has like this double thing. So there's an opportunity there to get a community of people who don't tend to have access to those kinds of opportunities or educational resources, financial resources. It doesn't help that the university is in the like fanciest part of town, right? But aside from that, he was the core reason why we were able to earn people's trust initially. And then, I mean, I think the other thing is being clear about why you're there and how long you plan to be there. And so it was an evolving commitment, but once we decided we wanted to do the work there for a while, you know, we were able to say like, hey, we're going to be back next year. And we came back every semester until Rennell was disinvited from his position because his higher ups weren't liking how much he was shaking things up, unfortunately. So having somebody like that is so crucial, because otherwise, you know, there's plenty of well-meaning folks who want to do this kind of work, community-based arts work, but, you know, how do you earn the trust of a community? And I think the only way really is to forge personal relationships with people in that community. And if you can manage to forge relationships with people who are influential in that community, who already, I mean, this guy's already like a important provider of social services, youth services, educational services for that community. So he was like a known guy. Yeah. And so that was awesome.
I want to move on to some of your more recent work, but before we do that, could you just share one moment of connection or one thing you learned when you were doing this project?
Yeah, one thing that's really been on my mind is the fact that we brought that group from its like underserved low income neighborhood. We kind of brought them on like tours, and they played at the concert hall at the university. They played at a street festival and like a fancy beachside community. They played at the art museum. And then on the flip side, we brought musicians from UCSD down to their community, and we hosted like a neighborhood music festival. And we weren't really sure what that meant because we didn't really know who was playing music in the area, but we found a couple of folks who were based there. And then we scheduled little impromptu scheduled sets by the graduate student musicians at UCSD, and then we also scheduled sets by the group of children, the Universal Language Orchestra. And one of the real amazing takeaways from that like didn't happen when we were in the setting of the concert hall or the museum was like the kids felt really comfortable in their own neighborhood, and they wound up like jamming with the grad students. And I have amazing photos, no audio sadly, of like kids playing the instruments they built, like a cajon, like a, you know, drum made of out of a box, or like different kinds of xylophones made from things you can get at the hardware store, just like jamming out with somebody playing like a Stradivarius contrabass. And I've been thinking about that a lot. I'm trying to figure out what the like lesson or the message of that is. I think there's a few that you could possibly extract, but it was a really amazing experience to see how easy those boundaries could be to cross if you have the right folks, you know, kids who have been taught that you can make music any way that you can, and that this is an okay way to make music. If you have adults who are similarly down, there's really no barrier stopping that from happening. And so I'm interested in more stuff like that happening all the time. Like, I want to try to live in a world where stuff like that is constantly happening.
That was artist and Skidmore professor Adam Tinkle. To hear the rest of that interview, check us out on Facebook or mediasanctuary.org. We usually have the stuff uploaded at least within a day.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Today we have Ed McDonough, who's the Democratic Commissioner for the Rensselaer County Board of Elections. Ed joins us tonight to help us understand what happened in Troy's District 2 City Council race, which came down to a single vote. Thank you for joining us, Ed.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you're the Democratic Commissioner for the Rensselaer County Board of Elections, and there's also a Republican Commissioner, Larry Bugbee. Why do the two dominant parties have their own commissioner? And do you think it's a good idea for smaller parties to have a commissioner as well?
Well, the New York State Legislature was responsible for creating the Board of Elections. And they felt at the time that the two parties that were in control, the top two, meaning in this case the Democratic and the Republican parties, would be best to represent. It's all based on the results of the gubernatorial election, which determines who the top two parties are. When it comes to minor parties having commissioners, I don't know if I would agree that it would be best for that to happen, because a lot of the minor parties seem to come and go. They might be around for maybe 4 years, 8 years, and then they don't receive the amount of votes which requires them to become or to stay a constituted party. So I think there would be a lot of changeover, which is very difficult when you're doing this kind of job, to continually have somebody changing and learning their roles.
What's the role the Board of Elections Commissioners. What is it that they do, and how do you get the job of doing it?
Well, to get the job, you have to be chosen by your party. So I'm chosen every 4 years at a meeting of the Rensselaer County Democratic Committee. My counterpart, Larry Bugbee, would be the same with the Republican Party. Once we are selected, we then our names are submitted to the county legislature for approval, and then we take our position. You know, our role is many. As supervisor of our staff, we currently have 10 employees at the Board of Elections. We also have part-time employees, election inspectors. We have over 400 election inspectors that we're in charge of hiring, training. We have machine custodians who program the machines, deliver the machines. We do everything that you could think of when it comes to running for office.
You just said you had 400 election inspectors?
Correct.
Is that 400. A one-day job or is it a multi-day job?
It can be a one-day job, depending. Well, this year's a prime example. We will be having a special election for the 107th Assembly District. So we will have a primary where inspectors will work that day. We also have a June congressional primary, as well as our normal September primary and then the November election. So an inspector could actually be working four times this year.
Oh. I myself worked for the very first time in the election. I was over at the Rensselaer County office building.
Yes, that's my office. Yes, correct.
So I think we'd like to talk a little bit about the District 2 City Council race, which was kind of remarkably close race, came down to a single vote, which to me, and I think to a lot of people, demonstrates the importance of and the meaning of participating in local democracy, that really one person can make a difference. So we'd like to talk a little bit more about how that election panned out. So could you just, for the listeners who don't know, give us the basics of what happened?
I want to make sure, tell us where District 2 is.
District 2 is the election districts 7 through 10 in the city of Troy, predominantly north central and the southern portion of Lansingburg. Yes, you're right. In this case, we had a five-time incumbent, Councilman Mark McGrath, being challenged by Miss Cindy Barkley. There were two races actually decided by one vote. In September, Ms. Barkley challenged Mr. McGrath on the independence line as a write-in. She was defeated by a vote of 16 to 15. So once again, that one vote came into place. Fast forward to November, the results ultimately were a one-vote loss for Ms. Barkley or a one-vote victory for Mr. McGrath, whatever way you wanted to look at it. But it was more of a roller coaster ride. On the night of the election, when the polls closed, our first numbers indicated that Ms. Barkley was down by 13 votes. We had a situation at the polling location, the Knickerbocker Ice Rink, where everybody in the second council district votes. There were ballots that did not go in the machine, so they were classified as emergency ballots. We had to count those the next day. After counting those, Ms. Barkley picked up a +4 margin. So now, on election night being down 13, the next day she was down by 9 votes. 2 days later, we opened up the absentee ballots. There was some back and forth. There were some objections. We ultimately opened all but 6 of the absentee ballots, of which Ms. Barkley gained 10, which put her up by one vote. The 6 objections, 3 by attorneys representing Mr. McGrath, 3 by attorneys representing Ms. Barkley. After some discussion, Mr. McGrath's attorneys dropped their objections to the 3 ballots. At that time, we opened the 3 ballots, and Ms. Barkley picked up 2 of the 3, so she gained another vote. So ultimately, she was up by 2 votes going into the last 3, where at that point, Ms. Barkley felt very strongly that those ballots did not meet the requirements to be opened. For one reason or another, she filed a lawsuit, which brought us to Supreme Court. Ultimately, Judge Gerald Connolly decided after a three-day hearing that the ballots would be opened. We did open those ballots, and Mr. McGrath received all three, and resulting in his one vote.
I mean, what is it about a vote that makes it objectionable, or what were these details of this absentee ballot that were debatable that decided whether or not it would be counted?
Well, it just so happened Ms. Barkley, in her outside job, works in apartment buildings, and the one ballot was objected to because she had never seen this person on the lease. She'd never, and she was the manager of this building. So that was one of the reasons that she objected to it. The other was an issue where the two people were members of the military. The question was not whether they were allowed to vote, because certainly they were. It was whether or not they were allowed to vote from the residence that they claimed. And ultimately, the judge decided that their vote would be counted.
One of the questions that occurs to me is that of an election decided by one vote seems to me to hardly be a mandate from the public. What were the, I mean, that's a divisive sort of situation when there's only one vote. So how do you, two questions, I guess. What was the dividing issue here? And also, or what were the dividing issues in this election? And also, how does a person who's only received the majority by such a small margin go about entering a government position?
Well, it's hard when you're running for a lower leveled office like a council position. It's more so a popularity contest. You know, the people in the second district had known Mr. McGrath. Like I said, he had been there for 10 years as an elected representative. He had a track record of what he was able to do for the residents in the second council district. Ms. Barkley, being new to the election process, it was more getting out, meeting people in the community, knocking on the doors and trying to explain what she felt she could do to make their neighborhoods a better place to live. And so when it comes down to lower levels, and I'm not trying to say lower levels, but, you know, not something like a mayor or a county executive or so on and so forth, it's more how many people you get to knock on their door to express your platform and to get them to believe that you'll be the right person to make decisions on their behalf.
You need to recognize, too, that when you talk about a mandate, that really means that you have large support. And elections are always, you know, one or two. You know, one person wins, one person doesn't.
Oh, absolutely. And in this case, if you look at the numbers, and once again, it was a one-vote margin, but actually 54 people who walked into the polling location that day decided not to vote for that race. And now when you look at the end result being one, you know, you really scratch your head and say, boy, if anybody had decided, you know, I am going to go down the ballot and vote for my council representative, you know, we could have a different representative, or it could have been a larger margin of victory. Who's to know?
So you by saying 54 people decided not to vote, they voted for something. They voted for other categories.
Correct.
They just didn't vote in that category.
That's correct.
How important are the city council positions? You know, how does it affect people's daily lives? In Troy, neighboring cities?
Well, it's a checks and balance. Mm-hmm. It's a checks and balance to make sure that, in this case, the mayor, what he's doing, you know, I don't know what the best terminology would be, just to make sure what he's planning on doing at least has the, in this case, you've got six council district representatives as well as the one at large president. So you now have seven people representing small communities to say, hey, I don't necessarily think what you're doing is going to affect my constituents, where in a positive way, where maybe somebody in the southern or northern district or central district might have a different opinion. So you've got seven different people that are basically supervising him to make sure that what he plans on implementing passes, I guess, the smell test, so to speak.
Yeah. I've been voting in the Troy elections for about 45 years now, so I know that there have been decades when people of different parties were very cooperative. And I think we're right now at a point where cooperation is always, you have to negotiate your cooperation a great deal now. So from my viewpoint, yeah, it's really important who gets in. Yeah. But I wondered if you thought this year there was more activity in running for election.
Unfortunately, no. And I still can't put my finger on it. And I've been here at the Board of Elections for now entering my 28th year. And, you know, people, they register to vote. It's their civic duty to do so. But it's getting them to go to the polls. Prime example, once again, going back to the 2nd District, only 27% of the registered people in that district came out and voted. 27%, it's very sad. In comparison to a presidential or a gubernatorial, where last year in the Trump-Clinton race, 75% came out and voted. You know, I understand it's president or it's governor and it's a high office, but these are the people that really are ultimately working on your behalf. And even in the mayoral years, the numbers are very low, maybe 35 to 40%, which is sad. Now, why that is, I guess, is the question that nobody seems to have the answer.
Has it always been like that?
Statistically, yes. Unfortunately, when it comes to localized races, the numbers drop drastically.
Do you have ideas about why the turnout rate is so low or how that could be improved?
You know what? I really don't. I mean, I guess the first thing you would think of is the youth, you know, making sure that people, when they are, they turn the age of 18, that they are reminded that they can register to vote, that they can be a part of who is going to be talking on their behalf as an elected official. It's important, but unless there's some specific person, and I guess I can look back to when President Obama ran for the first time, it was people were coming from all over to register and to make sure not just to register, but to follow through and vote. They believed in what he said as a person. And I just don't know if people turned off by politics in general, or they just haven't found that person that's ignited them to really come out and rally to cast a vote.
So we only have a couple minutes left. Maybe in that couple minutes you can talk about if someone did want to register to vote, how they could do that, and then sure. You know, where the polling places are, and also maybe if someone wanted to run for office, how they would go about doing that.
Absolutely. Well, the first thing I would recommend always would be to contact our office at the Rensselaer County Board of Elections. Our main number is area code 518-270-2990. We have our website, which is www.rensco.com. When you were get on that website, you would hit departments, hit elections, and when you go onto our page, there are numerous forms, registration forms, absentee ballot applications. We have a guide for running for office, which is available online as well as in our office. So I would always recommend coming into us. We could sort of direct you as to where you should go and what to do. Polling locations throughout the city are also located on the website as well.
So how does somebody do absentee voting? What circumstance?
Well, nowadays it's changed. If you believe that you're not going to be, I'll use an example. I'm a truck driver and I believe I'm going to be in Montana. So it's my right to vote. I fill out an application. If the day of the election comes and I'm not in Montana, I have the right to go to the polls and vote. We just wouldn't count your absentee ballot. But if, you know, it's more work-related, it can be health-related, there's numerous reasons that somebody would qualify for an absentee ballot.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this today, but thank you so much for joining us, Ed.
No, thank you for having me.
That was Ed McDonough, the Democratic Commissioner for the Rensselaer County Board of Elections, sharing with us the details of Troy's District 2 City Council race, which came down to a single vote and was ultimately decided by the courts, as well as some local politics basics.
For those just tuning in, I'm Annie.
And I'm Jonah Moberg. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or on Facebook.
Up next, we have our next segment with Megan Marone interviewing David Borton in our physics segment entitled Equality Under the Law.
We are back with David Borton and Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. Welcome back, David.
Well, good to be back. Nice sunny day out there. It's cold, though.
Cold, but beautiful. Yeah, sun streaming in. Well, look at us looking at the sun. It seems to be the motif.
Yeah, solar energy. And you wanted to talk about radio waves and how they're related.
Yes, please. So what would be the first point you would bring up in connecting solar energy to radio waves?
Well, before we do that, let's go out in the playground.
Remember? Oh, cool.
Remember we were out there shooting baskets a while back?
We got through it.
Yeah, and you went swish. So
we learned Newton's two laws, right? Three laws.
Right.
The first being that an object in motion stays in motion and an object at rest tends to stay at rest.
Good.
The second one being that force changes acceleration. And the third, dun, dun, dun. Oh.
Well, that if there's an action, a force in one direction, there's an equal and opposite.
Force in another direction?
In the opposite direction.
Opposite direction.
Okay. Good. All right. So let's not play basketball. Let's play on the swings.
Oh, that's up my alley.
Okay. So how do swings work?
Well, some kids pump their feet to keep going higher and higher once they get that initial push. A human being sits in a swing, and then another human being pushes that human.
Okay, let's just start with a person sitting at the bottom, okay? They get on.
Okay.
And then one of us pushes the other one up for a while, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when you're pushing somebody up like that, what are you doing?
Using strength, using force.
Right. And when you use force, what's the word that we call it? Okay. You lift the person from down here, they come up here on the swing, right?
Okay.
And what does that do to their energy?
First, they have potential energy. Well, you've pushed them.
Right.
So the force of the push causes the person to fly through the air.
Okay. I want to make it a little more simple. Okay. So you're sitting there, and I don't push for very hard or very long. I just push and hold you up here. You're now up here before I let go. So mm-hmm. What have I given you?
Potential energy.
Good. Okay. So now if I let go, what do you do?
I have kinetic energy.
Right.
You're gaining speed as
right,
you come down.
Right. That's Newton's mm-hmm. second law. So, okay. Now you come back to where we started.
Okay.
And when we started, do you still have any potential energy?
No.
Okay. So you're all kinetic energy, right?
Okay.
If I don't get there and stop you and run into you, what do you do?
There's potential energy. Kinetic.
You keep swinging, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you go past where you started and you swing up the other side.
Okay.
And so your kinetic energy changes back into?
Potential.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then it swings back down, potential to kinetic, kinetic to?
Potential.
And back and forth, right? And what do you think about the total energy, the whole system?
It's a contained energy system, right?
Right. So if it's contained, energy is conserved.
Oh, right. Okay. We have a conservation of energy within that contained pendulum swing world.
Oh, good. Just exactly right. So conservation of energy is a really big thing in the world. In a swing, there's a little bit of resistance from the air, and that would be a force. And a force does what? Newton's second law.
Well, doesn't it either accelerate or slow us down?
Okay. In this case, it's not going to accelerate us. It's going to...
The air pressure will slow us down, or air resistance specifically.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the person sitting on the swing will slowly wind down a little bit, mm-hmm. okay? But that energy is just being changed into heat, so energy is conserved on a bigger system.
Okay.
Okay. Now then, what are you pushing? What am I, if I'm pushing you on the swing and I'm lifting you up, what am I lifting you up against?
Gravity.
Gravity, exactly. Okay. We call it in physics a gravitational field. Talked a little while back about the way light works in a field. It's gravitational field is sort of like that. What can you remember about that?
And the way that the flame emits photons and the photons eventually travel from the center of the flame itself back up to the stars.
It goes out in all directions, and that's the way the gravitational field is. There's a gravitational field attracting you to the center of the Earth. There's a gravitational field holding the Earth in orbit around the Sun. There's a gravitational field from the Earth that keeps the Moon going around. So gravitational fields all around. All masses have gravitational fields. So we got conservation, we got fields. Let's talk about magnetism.
Sure. Before we go into magnetism, though, could you just give us one other concrete example from the world of a contained energy system and the law of conservation within that contained energy system?
Wow.
How about a solar boat? A solar boat, right?
Well, the nice thing about a solar boat is that the system is very large because it includes the sun's energy coming into the boat, so that there's always, in the daytime anyway, solar energy being brought into the boat. So the system is pretty big, right? But if you look at the system including the sun and the earth, then yes, it's all contained.
Okay, thank you for thinking about that. So you wanted to talk about magnetism, though.
Well, magnetism is a field. Have you experienced two magnets and how they work together?
Sure.
Tell me about it.
Put the same poles up against one another, they repel one another. If you put the opposite poles to each other, there's that automatic snapping attraction there.
Right. And we call those attractions and repulsions...
good times.
We were using the word force in Newton's laws, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So these forces and the magnets have around them a...
field. Yeah, magnetic field.
Mm-hmm. Magnetic. Okay. Now, have you ever walked across a rug in the winter and then touched a piece of metal?
Yes.
And what happens?
Gazap.
Gazap. Exactly. As you walk across the rug, you generate an electric charge on your body, and so you generate an electric...
well, your own electric field.
Your own electric field, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. And that electric field, when it's discharged to something, causes a gazap.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have you ever seen outdoors, when we're on the playground, a great big zap?
Yes.
What is that?
Lightning.
Lightning, exactly right.
So is that the atmosphere accumulating electric energy and then centralizing it, and it comes into contact with electric energy on the surface of the earth?
That's pretty close to the way physicists would describe it. Not exactly, but yes. So the electric charge builds up.
Did you hear that, folks? Pretty close to the way a physicist would describe it. I'm going to hold on to that little comment. Keep that with me through 2018.
Okay, so you've generated this electric field, and lightning generates an electric field. And just when you got close to the metal, the electric field broke down and there was a spark. The electric field breaks down, and that's called lightning. And so the lightning is the spark when the electric field breaks down.
Oh, cool.
And it neutralizes the charge.
So it's two similarly charged electric fields meeting one another.
Well,
when the lightning
field
becomes a spark, or when you actually see a spark of static electricity, yeah, on the rug.
Yeah, it's a positive field attracted to a negative field, and the current flows between them, and the current is the spark.
Oh, okay, cool. Now, how is that current and the spark related then to magnetic fields? They work in similar ways?
Okay, well...
electric and magnetic fields work in similar ways?
Yes, think of them as fields, okay? There's an electric field just like there's a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
In the swing, we had what kind of energy going into what kind of energy?
Kinetic moving into potential, kinetic, potential, kinetic, potential, a pendulum.
Yes, exactly right. In electricity, the same thing happens. The electric energy can go to magnetic energy, and the magnetic energy can go back to electric. So it moves back and forth. The field, the electric field grows, and then it starts to get smaller. As it starts to get smaller, the magnetic field grows. So it's similar to a pendulum in that case.
Can you describe with the lightning the movement between electric and magnetic? Or is that difficult? Is there another concrete example that you could give us?
A whole variety of things, like Ampere's law. So Ampere's law talks about the fact that when the lightning flows, the current flows, that flow of electricity makes a magnetic field.
Okay.
Magnetic field can move and it can make an electric field. Take my word for it that the electric energy and the magnetic energy go back and forth the way in a pendulum the gravitational energy and the kinetic energy goes back and forth. Yeah, vectors are cool. In a gravitational field, there's a vector because the gravity always goes in a certain direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a magnetic field, there's a vector because it's in directions. Have you ever seen a magnetic field?
Quickly define vector, though, for any listening audience that doesn't know a vector.
Okay, a vector is something that has a magnitude and a direction.
Okay.
So, 10 pencils tells you how many pencils, okay? But something like a force of 10 pounds, the force has a direction as well as the magnitude.
Cool. We'll have to have another whole segment on vectors and parabolas. It's my dream to have a segment with you on parabolas.
All right, let's do
if
it.
If that's okay.
Yeah, okay. But let's stick with this magnetic field going to electric and back. Okay, that has a name, and the name is photon.
Oh, boy. I love when things come together.
Yeah, okay.
Because now we have a direct connection to last week's discussion.
Right. And right now, my hand is receiving some photons from my favorite source of energy, which is...
the sun!
Yes, okay. Mm-hmm. So photons from the sun are my favorite photons, but you're a radio person, so what are your favorite photons?
I would say it's a tie between the sun and radio waves.
Okay. What particular radio waves are you liking right now?
I'm really digging ultraviolet. I'm not supposed to say that, though. You want me to say that I'm digging the megahertz of 105.3 FM Troy WOOC, right?
And give that a number.
105.3, right?
105.3 megahertz, right.
Okay.
Now, what do you know about the light that is shining on us? What about the megahertz of that?
The light that is streaming into this studio shining on us? You mean the solar light?
Yeah, right.
How do we label that? How do we number it?
Well, the frequency of that is like 10 to the 15th, whereas megahertz, what is mega?
Well, it sounds like a lot.
Mega is 10 to the 6th, and 10 to the 15th is like 10 to the 9th more.
Uh-huh.
So the light coming in has a much higher frequency than the light that's going out as these radio waves.
Can you repeat that? The light coming in has a much higher frequency.
Yeah. The light of the sun is a much, much higher frequency photon than the frequency of the radio waves leaving here, actually leaving from my house, here to my house as an electric current. And then the radio waves go from there out in all directions.
Hmm.
Like the candle that we had a while back.
Nice.
Okay, so the light, if you put a prism in front of the light, what do you get?
Rainbow.
A rainbow. Okay. Rainbows are great. That's a spectrum of light, a spectrum of photons, a spectrum of electromagnetic radiation.
Okay.
Okay? And now your radio dial has a spectrum of electromagnetic radiation too, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there are some of those other radio stations that we don't listen to that are in the radio spectrum, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now if you go a little higher in frequency, what do you get?
X-rays, gamma rays.
That's going to the extreme other end of the spectrum. Mm. Now, what's in between?
Well, infrared and ultraviolet, what we spoke about last week.
Yeah, those are extensions of the visible spectrum, right? Mm-hmm. Ultraviolet is a higher energy, and infrared is a longer wavelength, lower energy.
You might want to shoot me for asking this on the spot, but also, what's the deal with photons and bioluminescence? Are there waves, you know, like creatures that can glow in the ocean, or waves? There are certain beaches, I guess, that are completely bioluminescent.
Wait a minute. Back up. What are you made of? We talked about that
protons,
last time.
Protons, electrons.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. So if there is an electron that is raised to a higher energy level, it will tend to fall down to a lower energy level.
Okay.
And conservation of energy, if it goes from high energy to low energy, something must happen. Some energy has to leave, right?
Right.
Okay, that leaves as a photon.
Oh.
The bioluminescence is when a electron in this, whatever it is that's bioluminescing.
A cuttlefish.
There you go. Okay.
Algae.
Yeah, all those things. An electron falls from a higher energy level to a lower energy level, and it gives off a photon.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
So that's what's happening in this whole electromagnetic spectrum.
Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have any other words that you want to say about the electromagnetic spectrum? I mean, my dream for 2018 is that we could have an even more extended discussion on the wonder of bioluminescence and parabolas.
All right, let's do that. But let's also recognize that there's the spectrum for your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
There's the spectrum for the microwave oven. There's the spectrum for the heat that comes off of your wood stove.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things are photons in the broader electromagnetic spectrum.
Why is it important for us to think about photon emission with our wood stove or somebody right here in the neighborhood cooking a barbecue, lighting a candle?
Well, the simple answer is solar energy, right? because all life on Earth is sustained by solar energy. So all of these things are related, and the energy source is solar energy.
Well, thank you so much for being here, David. And I can't wait for us to come back with a bioluminescent discussion.
Very illuminating. Thank you.
That was local physicist and solar boat builder being interviewed by WOOC correspondent Megan Marone.
In December, Capital Roots Education Coordinator Cassie Andrews asked Hudson Mohawk Network correspondent Dave Pablo to record a series, interviews by local high school students of the local gardeners who participate in Capital Roots farming program. For today's show, we'll play an interview with George Woodard, who gardens at Tivoli and North Albany, those two gardens. The interviewers are Manuel Perez, a 12th grader, and Thais Pratt, who is in 9th grade.
Hi, I'm Annie, and
I'm Thais.
And my name is George Woodard.
All right, can you tell us a little about yourself?
Well, I was born and raised in the city of Albany, and basically went to school and everything there. Married, had a family, and everything like that. And basically, dilly and dally and a lot of different things, politics and stuff like that. Worked a lot with young kids, trying to keep them straight and let them know what's out there in the world for you. And that's about it.
Mind if I ask a follow-up on that?
Pardon?
Do you mind if I ask a follow-up on it?
Want me to follow up on it?
Oh, no, I was going to ask, how'd you get involved with helping young kids?
Basically, coming from a certain area of Albany, you see a lot of kids standing and doing anything. And when you really see that, the community is not going up, the community is going down. So working with them and trying to get them out of the street and get them in back in school and show them the right way instead of the wrong way. And most of the kids have went on and did very well. As a couple of times I get in conversations with leaders in city of Albany, and I tell them, the kid that's standing over there on that corner has got a higher IQ than the guy that's walking around with the badge. And when you really put it together and test and see, you will see that. So somebody's got to do it, and that's the bottom line.
All right, thank you. So how long have you been in gardening?
My first garden was up the street. I live on Morris Street, right behind the College of St. Rose. And it was right up in park, in part of College of St. Rose. That was my first garden. And then I had another one down at Ritzfield. I don't know if you know anything about Albany. That's where they have the tennis courts made out of clay. And I had one there. And then they closed that one up. And no, that one still goes. And then I went down to Normanskill. And I was in Normanskill for a while until they had the big washout and the soil got contaminated. But now I see it's back up and running. And then I was over on Sand Street. You know how you go to College of St. Rose Field where they play at? Over in that area. And now I'm in North Albany, and I also have one up, you know where Livingston Village is on Livingston Avenue? Well, then it's no sense in talking about it.
Could you tell us a story about you, about something you learned while gardening?
See, basically, all of my family came from a small town in Mississippi called Shibuti, Mississippi. And that's all they did was garden. You know, and one day my cousin, and his name is R.G., and I'll tell you a little bit about that. His name is R.G. McCall. We were sitting around, no, we were out hunting. And he said, when you gonna start gardening? I said, I ain't around nobody's garden. He said, yeah, but when hard times come, at least you know how to put a seed in the ground and grow. Makes sense. So that's how I got in the garden. Basically with a lot of my cousins and my fathers and my uncle. And they brought the garden from Mississippi to Albany. I don't know how, if you remember, if you're out by Cross Gates, in the back of Cross Gates, there's a road called Rap Road. Rap Road is a place that now has just been put on the National Historical because that's where a lot of my family went to because they were used to having a garden and living in the woods. And everybody's house had a garden. I went to England one time, and I went from England to Germany. My brother retired out of the military and stayed in England. I had a cousin that stayed in Germany, Berlin. As I left England and went to Berlin on the train, every house I passed on that train had a house and a garden. You might have seen a pig or you might have seen a cow, but you definitely seen chickens and flowers pot in each one of the windows that was facing that track. And I said to myself, these people ain't no more than my relatives. You know, it's a house, a garden, and something to eat if it wasn't no more than a chicken. I think this program, that what they're running here now with the young people, at least you will get that opportunity if hard times come, you know how to put a seed in the ground and eat. And what's that? The main thing, right? I hope I answered it.
All right, thank you. All right, well, Troy has a vibrant growing focus on local and community gardening. How would you describe the importance of community gardening for our future?
Everybody's going to eat. I think it's a good thing, and it works. It's something that works. Mm-hmm. That's the important thing. It works. You know, you put it in there, and then when you see it grow, you're very happy that you've seen something come up that you can eat right then and there. As my father said one time, I'm not a shell peas. I don't know if you ever know what I'm talking about. Yeah. Well, you take a string bean or a black-eyed pea and you shell it. You open it up and shell the seeds. I'm not a shell. But I remember when I used to go to Mississippi to see my aunts sitting there shelling peas. I'm not a shell. My cousin would say, you see that? You get that nail and you can run it right up that and open it up. I'm not a shell. And as my father would say, if you don't take it out of the grocery store, you're going to starve. Because if hard times comes, you're going to starve. So you better learn how to put something in that ground so you're going to have something to eat. So I found somebody else to do the shelling for me, to be honest. It was an older lady, and she caught me off surprise. She says, she said, well, you know, I take my half. You got to take your half, you take your half, because I'm not a sheller. And that's how it was in Mississippi. They would shell for the person, they took their half, and the other person that they were shelling for would take theirs. And that's how they survived down there. And that was life. But it came out of the garden. Yeah.
On a lighter note, what
I
are
hope
some...
I'm not boring you.
Oh, no, you're fine. Thank you.
What are some of your favorite things to grow?
That I've grown with these guys a lot. Like the rutabaga, not the rutabaga. Yeah, the rutabaga that the gentleman brought in here, it was good. You know, it's just that my mother used to do it and chop up the small pieces of pork fat and put it in there with it to give it flavor. The biggest thing that I introduced it to the garden, community garden, was sweet potatoes. They didn't think sweet potatoes would grow up here. And you make a row as long as this table. You rototill the dirt up and this is when them guys was on my back. And I was the one that had to do the ordering. And I found the guy and I said, look, can you bring in the plants and the water? And I don't know what happened, but boy, that ain't what I wanted you to. I said, that's what they said. And he said, I don't care, that ain't what I told you. He said, I told you I wanted pool plant. I said, well, what's the difference? It's a plant, stick it in the ground, it's gonna grow. You call them back up and tell them to ship me some pool plants. A cutting is like when you go and take a plant and you cut something off from it and then stick it in the ground. That has got to make a root before it starts producing. A pool plant has a root. So which one is gonna grow faster?
Probably the first option.
Which one?
The first option.
No, the one with the root is going to start producing faster than the one that's got to make a root and then start producing. Ship them back. Nope, we don't take them back. So we had, but as the old guys from down south, you don't throw anything away. So we're going to start the roots over on this side and we're going to put the other ones over here. So what's the theory here? Well, we're going to pick them and then we're still going to have them coming along. So now you're going to have two crops instead of one crop. Then I said, Haji, what are you doing? He said, you cut these off the roots, and then we're gonna take them over there. I said, oh man, we're gonna be picking sweet potatoes from now on. But it works. So now we got three crops instead of two crops. And we had a lot of sweet potatoes that year. These are the things that you pick up from the older people. And what you picked up from the older people is how to survive. I asked my father, I said, Dad, what did you guys do when the big depression came on. He said, what depression? What do you mean, what depression? I said, well, people was jumping out of buildings. He said, oh, well, the only thing we could do is climb up in a pine tree and jump, but we didn't have nothing to jump from. But we were sharecroppers. I said, well, how did you? He said, we had money, but we didn't have a lot of money. And we would take the cane syrup. They had sugar cane. And they would put it in this thing and process it and get the sugar out of it. They would take that to the store and barter for meal, flour, and seasoning. And that's how they lived. Garden is a very, very important part of life today. If you go to some of the biggest states, you will see some of the biggest farms that you ever want to see. And if you notice right here in New York State, if you ever get out of Albany, like my grandson, going to Brockport, you're just riding and all you see is nothing but just fields and fields of corn. Or either you'll see fields and fields of cabbage. It's survivable. And what the community garden brings to the table is survival. They might not know it, but it is in a way of survival for people to survive off of. Because if things go sour, at least you know how to throw. As my father said, I said, Dad, I got these beans. He said, now the next time, you leave those beans out there until they dry. Here we go with another education. Why we gotta wait until they dry? Says if the power goes off and you got them in the freezer, what happens? If you let them go dry and you got them in a jar and you got them in your cabinet, put some water in there and let them boil, at least you're gonna have some beans. But what are you gonna eat when it's in the freezer and the power's gone and everything goes bad? All about education. And my cabinet is filled with beans. Yeah, it's really interesting, you know. So like I said, the community garden is doing something. At least if you go and learn how to plant and learn how to cook, you'll do very well if hard times ever did, which I wish it don't come. But we never know. You never know. And it's surprising that when you go overseas, and you see how these people live, a house, a garden, chickens, or something running around, you know. And they have their big cities and stuff like that, but you also got the ones like Rap Road. Every one of my cousins had a, and then my cousin Dan, he had a big pig farm, and, you know, they survived. I hope that's it.
All right, that's about it. All right, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for coming.
I hope I didn't bore you.
That was local gardener George Woodard, interviewed by Manuel Perez, a 12th grader, and Thais Pratt, who is in 9th grade. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Jonah Moberg.
And I'm Annie. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
And as a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering for our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07, held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media at 3361 6th Avenue in North Troy. Until next time, thank you for tuning in.